The sooner you give, the sooner you get to have a love of your own. The longer it takes, the better you'll come to know.
Yo, this is Danny Holloway. You're listening to dublab.com on a Friday night, and I'm in the studio with Ned Doheny. You just heard his song called For a Love of Your Own, and which I consider to be one of the top three love ballads of all time. I just got through telling Ned that. And we were just starting to talk about how the song was written with Hamish Stewart from the Average White Band. And welcome to the studio.
Thank you. Good to be here. Good to be asked. You here? Good.
Ned has had a very interesting career and association with music that has lasted since the 70s. And he was once associated with Jackson Browne, and he was in a group with Dave Mason, who wrote Feeling All Right, and Mama Cass from the Mamas and Papas. But really the most important thing to know is that Ned himself is a tremendous songwriter and is a very soulful singer-songwriter. And so that song, like I said, is one of my favorite songs of all time. And then he wrote a song that Chaka Khan covered called What You Gonna Do For Me. And he's playing tonight at the Virgil. It's an early kind of showcase show. It's going to be starting in a few minutes at 7 o'clock. And does it go, how long does it go for?
About an hour, I think.
Okay.
Give or take.
So, with that song that we just heard, A Love of Your Own, how did it break down in terms of your contribution and Hamish?
Well, Hamish and I were actually sitting at my kitchen table in Benedict Canyon, and we were fairly recent friends. And I had, obviously, I had enormous respect for Hamish, and I was, you know, we were all at the Troubadour when AWB played for the first time, and some real heavy hitters came down to see them, you know, Martha Reeves, and, you know, just everybody turned, there were a lot of classical R&B people that wanted to be part of it because they were so nasty. You know, they were such good players, and they could play and sing, and also their, you know, this word melisma, you know about that?
No,
melisma comes from gospel, and it's a lot of times it can be over singing in the hands of the uninitiated. But when two people really understand how to do that together, which of course they did, it can be really lovely. And I thought Alan Gorey and Hamish were so great at being able to both hold a groove and sing extremely complicated stuff at the same time. Beyond me,
wow.
Truly.
Yeah.
But around that period of time, AWB lost their drummer, and it was an unfortunate situation because they were at a party, and Robbie was given something that he thought was coke, and it was actually heroin. It killed him.
Right.
And that devastated Hamish because they were the closest of friends, and he and Ivy, you know, kind of met around that period of time, and that was really, A Love of Your Own was the first time we ever played together around the kitchen table, and the line, the was a guitar lick, plain and simple. And then he added da-da-do-da-do.
Right.
And then he also added the modulation that went up to the bridge. I wrote most of the lyrics, but he wrote the title, you know, I mean.
Wow, but such a true collaboration.
Oh, and it was so much fun to sing it that we just, you know, we would perform it at a moment's notice. So in those days, if you wrote something that you really liked, you tried to grab it while it was hot because you couldn't sample your way into it or music platform your way into it or sequence your way into it. You just tried to pick the usual suspects and see if you could make something happen. And it was just really,
like
really
I said, it may, amazing song and you know, for lovers all over the world, I think that's a song that speaks for people's emotions, you know.
I hope so. I mean, yeah, I hope so.
And, you know, in the last 5 or 10 years, there's been a lot of focus on Laurel Canyon and Canyon music and all that kind of stuff. People are writing books about it now and everything like that, but you were living it. You were, you know, going up and down and hanging out with you know, everybody that was on the scene back then. What are your memories like of Laurel Canyon in the late 60s, early 70s?
Well, the thing that's interesting about it is that, you know, every period of time has its own zeitgeist. It's got its own timbre, its own rhythm. And when you're in the middle of it, you're completely unself-conscious about it. You don't know what's happening until you look at it with the gift of hindsight.
Right.
When you're in the middle of it, you're selecting the appropriate pair of jeans, and you're trying to look the part, and that's the way you're living. You're going to bed late, and you're going to bed late, and you're getting up late, and you know people are cross-pollinating both figuratively and literally, and there's a lot of interaction and healthy competition, really great competition, because you know a lot of people can't really, you know, you can build stuff in your studio, but then if I were to say to you, you know, pick up an instrument and show me what you did, you know, not everybody can make that happen.
That's true.
So in those days, you know, in order to get in the door of a publisher, you had to be able to, you know, show up.
Yeah.
With guns blazing, so to speak.
Well, I worked for a publishing company for 15 years, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
You had to come in there with songs that were well constructed, that made sense, and, you know, or else you're just not going to get anywhere with that.
True.
So, what inspired you to, I read that you got in, that you received a guitar as a gift when you were 4 years old. But what inspired you? What was it, how did what was your path into music, and how did your passion get started?
Well, you remember all this. I mean, there was a time when we all had clock radios.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you'd lie in bed at night, and the menu, you know, every evening's menu was so diverse. You know, there'd be, you know, a completely instrumental slide tune followed by a novelty tune followed by a doo-wop tune followed by, you know, some crushing shuffle or whatever. And you woke up to this and you went to sleep to this. And so you were bathing in it all the time.
This was the pioneering days of FM radio, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
In L.A. it was KPPC, I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you go to any of the Pinnacle concerts at the Shrine Auditorium?
No, I did. I did attend one memorable concert at the Cheetah. Remember that place?
Yeah, yeah. In Santa Monica.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I watched Jim Morrison get knocked out by the manager of the Blood, Sweat, and Tears. No, was it Blood, Sweat? No, it was American Electric Flag.
Oh, right, right.
He was trying to join the band, and he'd had way too much fun, and he was, you know, he tried to make his way up the steps for the third time, and these boys were from Chicago, and they were not taking any.
Right.
So he just rolled end over end to the bottom of the stairs and was dragged unceremoniously.
Yeah, you know, I saw
from
him.
The scene.
I saw him at the Whiskey before they had a record deal, and he was very introverted at that time, and the other group that was the headliner was Van Morrison's group, Them.
All right.
And I think when he saw how drunk they were on stage, that inspired him to overcome his shyness by drinking a lot. And that's my theory.
You may be right.
Yeah.
You may be right. Certainly his demons were robust.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
It's well documented, but Jim Morrison, you know, the majority of things that he needed to do in a day would all be near the intersection of San Vicente and Santa Monica. He lived in a motel there. His record company was a half a block down. The group's rehearsal room was across the street. His favorite bar to drink at was Barney's Beanery, which was like two doors down. So he just lived in that small little area.
Well, yeah, maybe he was trying to minimize his footprint or something.
Probably. Yeah. And so you started making records, and you were first in. I read also that you were the first artist on David Geffen's Asylum label.
Well, that's been bandied about. I don't really think that's true. I actually think Judy Sill was the first.
That's what I thought. I
thought Judy Sill was the first. But, you know, yeah. I mean, they just.
But you were there at the
very
beginning.
They keep asking me, and I keep denying it. You know.
But so, you were there at the very beginning.
Yeah, I was one of the first three or four people that were signed, yeah.
And
definitely.
What was the period that you lived in England? What years were that? Was that?
Oh, God. Well, after we did the Paxton Lodge thing, and I'm sure you heard about that.
There, yeah.
You know, there's an hour's worth of material on that one.
Yeah.
But I came back to Los Angeles, and usually whenever I found myself getting shot out of the saddle, I mean, make it sound like it happens every day, right? You take a shower, brush your teeth, and get shot out of the saddle. But I would always start studying again. So I after Paxton fell through, I found a really great classical guitar teacher, and I studied with him for a year. And I had the best teacher-student relationship I've ever had. Really the first true teacher-student relationship I've ever had, where people really influence each other.
Right.
You know, where he, I've had music that interested him, he had music that interested me. And he made me so strong that I had to kind of run away to figure out what I had. So I drove, that's when I went to England. That would be 1969.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know what to do. So I took the broadest form possible, which was, I thought, well, I'll just drive around the world. Now there's a great thinker for you, right? There are parts of, you know, especially in those days, there are parts of that journey where people would kill you for your shoes.
That's right.
So I really wasn't thinking clearly about that, but I got no further than England. And a girl that I know, since I truly believe that girls essentially make, or used to in those days, make the music business run. Everybody else tried to figure out what they wanted, and they just made it all happen. I mean, even Jackson. he was Geffen wasn't interested in him until some secretary fished his photograph and demo tape out of the trash.
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, her name was Nicole. She is as my as Monty Python used to say, singing with the choir invisible.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a real sweetheart, and she knew Mason, and she was married for a time to Steve Winwood, and so she took me out to meet him.
Oh, I knew her.
I'm sure you did.
She had blonde hair.
Yeah,
I knew her.
Sort of sandy.
Yeah, blonde hair. I knew her.
And she, anyway, she took me to meet Dave, and as fate would have it, my journey was beginning to produce results, because I wrote the first tune on the first album when I got to New York, and then by the time I got to England, I wrote another song called Trust Me on David's Floor, and it was good timing. You know, if you want to convince somebody that you're, you know, that you're at least threatening to be on fire, it's great to write a song right in front of them. So he asked me to join up with them, and I did that, and Cass was one of the smartest and most generous human beings I've ever met. And anybody that has known her will tell you exactly the same thing. I've been fortunate enough to know three or four of those people in my life. I consider myself blessed.
Dave Mason, for some reason, was portrayed as having a difficult personality. How did you find him?
Well, Dave and I used to just talk like pirates all the time and laugh.
Okay.
You know, so I... You know,
we kept it light.
Oh, yeah, we kept it pretty light. I mean, I didn't want to, you know, talk about the world navel or anything with him. He wasn't particularly into that. But, you know, I always found him really easygoing. I usually don't have a problem with many people, you know. But I had a little bit of a problem with Geffen in that group. But, you know, because Geffen really wasn't one of the guys, you know. He didn't really understand the guy thing so much. He did, but from a different perspective, you know.
Well, the article I read in Wax Poetics, it seemed that a lot of the business contacts that you ran into caused you to recoil. That you didn't, when you had a golden opportunity, you really didn't lean into it. You kind of shied away a lot of times.
Yeah, I did. Well, I did, and part of that, you know, when my parents raised me, they, you know, everything was pretty. How do I put it? My father was very honorable, and still is.
That doesn't exist in the music business.
No, and so my immediate response was, well, who the hell are these people?
Exactly.
I mean, you don't have to be perfect, but you have to at least meet me halfway. That
exactly.
would be fair.
Yeah.
So, and I was, you know, I was too impatient with what I considered to be, you know, gaping character flaws.
Right.
And, you know, also, the music business was a catch basin that caught up tremendous amounts of creativity and equally incredible amounts of exploitation. People who wished they were creative, who wanted to be near the creativity.
They wanted to put their stamp on something.
Who wanted to screw the creativity so they could feel more powerful than the creativity.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, that's a lot to take in when you're in your early 20s.
Uh-huh.
You know?
You know, I think we should play another tune. Have you got one ready?
I have name one.
We're going to play the Chaka Khan version of what's going to do for me. But yeah, back then it was a whole different thing. I mean, you and I have been in the music business about the same time. I started in 1970. Mm. I worked for Island Records for 23 years.
That must have been fun.
It was fun from the point of view that it was independent. And it wasn't a corporation, you know. It was owned by one man, and he was a decent human being. So,
I've heard.
Yeah, it worked. It worked out okay, but so I can relate to you in a lot of ways. I also grew up in L.A. I also lived in England for 5 years. I lived there from 70 to 75. Mm-hmm. During the same time we were in England. So yeah, there's a lot of touchstones there, but I didn't have your music talent. I'm currently a DJ, you know, so I spend...
Well, it's interesting that the DJ motif has become quite legitimate.
Yeah.
I mean, in another time, you know, it wouldn't have been
necessarily thought of as such, but, you know, I was talking to the people at the Numero Group, and they were, I was doing an interview with a magazine, and they were saying, well, you know, what do you think about don't you think it's unusual that people are starting to find your music again? I said, well, not really. If you consider the state of the music business, it's pretty insipid, and the music is really formulaic, so all that's left is hunting for buried treasure.
That's exactly right. That's what this whole radio station is about in a lot of ways. We cover two things. Hmm. We cover the unearthing things in the past, like what you just spoke of, and then the most adventurous music that people are attempting to make now. Those are the two areas we cover, don't you think so? Yeah. And so you mentioned Numero, and they're putting together a compilation album with some demos and things like that that they're going to be putting out of your material, right?
Yeah, there seemed to be, there were sort of like simultaneous awarenesses of my catalog that were happening in kind of Echo Park, Highland Park. I met a great guy named Scotty Coates who tracked me down and wanted me to come out to Palm Springs. I didn't know at the time. I thought I was just playing for some people. And we became really good friends. And then there was another guy in New York named Daniel Colas, who's a producer. And I found that there are a lot of these young guys who are, you know, really kind of loving all that stuff, especially because the To Prove My Love from the Prone album got a lot of DJ cred, and I got a lot. It was a big record in England, big record in London, and I didn't know. Of course, I would have gone immediately if I thought there was, you know, a prayer, but I didn't find out really until after the fact. Although they still play that.
You know what? We're going to go to this Chaka Khan tune, and then afterwards I want to talk about your relationship with Japan, because you had a lot of interest from Japan, and that lasted for decades for you. So let's touch on that after we get through hearing this tune.
Okay.
Trying hard to defend.
What You Gonna Do For Me, Chaka Khan. That's a song written by Ned Doheny and Haimé Stewart. In fact, that was the second song they wrote. The first one that you heard earlier, A Love of Your Own, that was the first song they ever wrote, and this was the second song. What happened after that?
Well, we were terrified of ever writing anything else because we were on a roll and we didn't really know what to do about that. Plus, Hamish would tell you that I tend to move pretty slowly, you know. And, I mean, Love of Your Own was written actually very quickly, and What You're Gonna Do For Me took a little bit longer, but not much. But, you know, I mean, everybody's, I mean, certainly they were touring and trying to do this and that. Hamish was going through his own stuff, and, you know, I mean, it's funny, you know, a friend of mine once said, somebody was talking about the Eagles or something, and they said that it's amazing how long that they've lasted and how few groups stay together really all that long. And my friend Gary said, you know, it's amazing that it happens at all. And so, you know, it really is an intersection where people collide in a very beneficial way.
Yeah, there's so many situations where there's probably the right talent gets together, but the personalities can't coexist.
True. And also, once again, you were talking about Laurel Canyon and all that. There really wasn't any self-consciousness about the period of time. It was simply we were all searching, chasing something. And if you were fortunate enough to chase that with somebody, to chase that vision with somebody who had a similar vision, then, you know, oftentimes you could shock yourself with the kind of stuff you could create. So,
let's briefly cover the story of how Chaka Khan heard that song, What You Gonna Do For Me. You were recording it as a demo?
Well, no. The AWB was recording it as a demo. And the thing about What You're Gonna Do For Me is it's pretty linear. The only time the chords really, the motif kind of runs through the verse and the chorus, which is a little confusing if you're just playing the track without anybody singing to tell you where you are. So they said, well, you come down and sing so we know where we are. And I said, yeah, sure, you know, of course. You know, why not? So I was in the vocal booth and I was just trying my best to, you know, hit the notes, and I wasn't trying to do anything spectacular. I just, you know, and then I looked into the control room and there was Chaka Khan. And she was a lot younger in those days, and she's a cute little bug, you know.
It's intimidating with that voice that she has,
well,
too.
Well, I mean, you know, I was just a skinny white guy from, you know, Westwood, so all of a sudden I see this, you know, truly one of the great American voices, and I was just thinking, oh God, you know. So they finished up the track and I went in the, you know, the control room, and she was very very warm and very supportive, and she said, you have really great control and this is a really wonderful vocal, and I thanked her profusely, and then I went back to do another, and then she stuck her head in the door and said, can I sing with you?
Wow.
Be still my heart. You know?
Mm-hmm.
That was a great thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, the session wrapped up, and the funny thing was that I think and I don't mean to sound arrogant about this, because I don't really feel anything remotely like that, but for some reason my voice and their track to me was really kind of more or less the song, and obviously Arif felt the same, because she took him a copy of their vocals on that track, and he said, don't hear it.
Yeah, she had to fight to be able to record it, right?
Well, she called me and said, do you have a cassette? Did you take home a rough of the vocal that you did? And I said, yeah, I did.
Yeah.
She said, can we have that? And she took that, and that's how they got it.
Oh, okay.
And listen, those guys can sing rings yeah. around me.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, but you, once again, look what we were talking about before. It's the timbre of the voice. It's the timing. It's not that you're necessarily great or not great. It's just that you happen to fit that moment.
That's right.
And that's really where the song is.
Yeah. So you poked around, you did five albums, and then you ended up finding a lot of support in Japan.
Redemption in Japan, yeah. No, I think Japan is... Well, in those days, it was one of those, I mean, they were much more keen on American artists I mean, you know, all that's changing. Now it's you know, it's 40 surgically enhanced Korean girls leaping and springing. That's popular music. So, but in those days, they, you know, meant quite a bit to them because they thought, well, this is the real deal, you know. So, and I had a whole string of, you know, nastinesses. My girlfriend moved out. One of my best friends lost his leg. I'm sure you read all this. And I was emptying bedpans and, you know, making meals and chain smoking camels, and it rained for 3 months. I mean, so when somebody called me and said, hey, would you like to go to Japan? I said, sure, why not? And I was treated quite well. And it's an utterly beguiling country, owing largely to the fact that there is great beauty there and also tremendous contradiction in every mouthful. You
really?
Know?
Really?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, things are contradicting each other all the time, which is great fun. And plus, they love to drink. They you know they'll they will. You know, I one occasion I saw probably 30 people fall down at a bus stop one night. One like dominoes. One person went woo, and then they were all on the ground, legs up in the air. You know,
that happens here at Dublab some nights.
Really? So it became kind of a home away from home for me. And
you had a radio show there?
I did something for the city of Yokohama. There was a song on that I wrote. They asked me to write a song for the city, and I wrote a song called Between Two Worlds, which is on an album I finished 3 or 4 years ago, which is actually, I love that record, but you probably never heard that record.
No.
Anyway, so I had a relationship with the city, and there was the Yokohama radio station that asked me to be a DJ, at which I admittedly suck, because I'm not that curious, you know. If something hits me over the head, then I, you know, it's like, I'll listen to that. But I'm kind of swimming in it, so I don't, you know, I'm not as curious as I should be about what other people are up to. But yeah, and it was quite nice. I mean, almost a year.
Tell me what it feels like to have pursued music in your youth and now to be coming out and starting to do it all over again. How does it feel?
It's really strange. And I was coming into town with my wife today, who's Japanese also. And I looked at her and I said, what am I doing? What the hell am I doing? I'm officially off-roading. You know, whatever path I thought I was on has given way to, you know, chaparral and you know, cactuses, because I'm now officially a stranger in a land I don't recognize.
Yeah.
But what's great about it is that, and I can really thank my father, especially for this, my mom also, is that it's the things we love that really keep us alive. And, you know, I can still groove with some violence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and music still gets to me. But, you know, it's kind of because we were in an atmosphere where everybody was doing that, it was much more conducive to everybody kind of offering their creations. Now, you know, it's like, the guy who's playing bass with me tonight, Edwin, said, yeah, he said, you know, it's interesting. He said, the bad guys aren't even bad anymore.
Yeah.
You know, the guys are like, oh, like this guy, him, you know, not so much. So even the guys that are supposed to be killer are basically lightweights, and that's the era we're living in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they call it, sometimes they call it, in the rap world, they call it studio gangsters.
Man, yeah. I do feel a little anachronistic, but you know, life continues to amaze me, so I follow.
Yeah, right now there's a lot of from young people in general. I think like people under 40, there's a lot of curiosity and acceptance of a lot of different things. People are, you know, I think the internet has kind of opened up people's minds a little bit to make them curious about things. So. I'm glad you're a part of it, man. I'm glad that people have rediscovered you.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it's. I mean, God, you know, it's sort of like message in a bottle stuff.
Yeah.
You know, somebody pulled one out and read it. How about that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, personally, I think, I've always been a fan for a long time now, and I think it's nice to see you get your due.
Well, I mean, you know, that they're, yeah. I agree. I mean, it's nice to be recognized for the work you did, sure.
Exactly.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right, man. So nice to have you come through. And I know I heard the sound check earlier. It's going to be an amazing show here in a few minutes. Ned Doheny at the Virgil. And then are you going to continue to play dates or what?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of time. I mean, of late, I've just been playing by myself. I'm trying to prove to people that it is possible to create dance music, you know, spontaneously. Not necessarily dance music, but physical music,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I've been playing a lot by myself, and that's really fun.
Yeah.
So tonight I'm kind of with a bunch of people, so I'm going to be, you know, looking for my
footing. It sounded very organic. It sounded really nicely organic.
Well, I'd love to hit all the... I just want to hit all the notes. That's basically... I'm still in the vocal booth trying to not, you know, upset AWB.
Well, again, it's great to see you and great to have you come through, and welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
All right, Ned. This is Danny Holloway, dublab.com. We're about to shift into something else. Let's go, Diego.
Get it!